long-term capital management, I had been maniacally focused on avoiding such risks, acutely aware that I needed to protect our assets, and I didn't have a single cent of leverage or debt, either personally or in the fund. Bear Stearns was simply our custodian, which meant that our cash accounts were theoretically not vulnerable at all. Even so, the unpredictability of the situation was terrifying. In reality, who could say what would happen to these segregated accounts if Bear went under? All bets were off. I was sitting at my desk in my office in Manhattan on the afternoon of Sunday, March the 16th, watching financial history unfold. The office was eerily quiet. Everything seemed to be happening in slow motion. I knew that I wasn't in control, that my fate was in the hands of Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and other policy makers whose sole interest, rightly, was to protect the global financial system, not me, my fund, or my investors. Potentially, almost all of my family's net worth was at risk, along with the savings of dozens of friends, relatives, and business associates. Even so, in this moment of crisis, I felt strangely calm. All of a sudden, my Bloomberg monitor came to life, lighting up with a newsflash that J.P. Morgan Chase had decided to acquire Bear Stearns. I reached for the phone and called my father to share the news. Later that evening, I dialed into a conference call and listened with overwhelming relief to Jamie Dimon's assurance that J.P. Morgan stands behind Bear Stearns, guaranteeing its counterparty risk. Never have such prosaic words meant so much to me. Even as I write this, I feel a wave of emotion. The Bear Stearns bullet, which I had not even known to exist until a few days earlier, had come appallingly close. But we had been saved. I've never met Jamie Dimon, but I've sent him a Christmas card every year since. I once saw him at a cocktail party in Davos and didn't speak to him, but I was tempted to go over to him and give him a hug. Another ordeal that is seared into my memory occurred in September 2008. We had just returned from a wonderful family vacation in Europe. Laurie and I recently had our third child, and we were happily ensconced in a new apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side. Then, on that sunny September afternoon, my father phoned me out of the blue to ask if I thought Lehman Brothers would go bankrupt. Most of his money was invested in the Aquamarine Fund, but it turned out that he had also stashed a sizable chunk of his liquid assets in Lehman Brothers bonds. Now it looked like Lehman was in a death spiral. I was almost speechless. We had recently escaped disaster with Bear Stearns, and now this? I paced around my living room, listening to my father in disbelief. Lehman Brothers bonds? You bought Lehman bonds? Why? I couldn't imagine how he could possibly have stepped into this minefield. Less than a year earlier, I had listened to a superb presentation on Lehman by David Einhorn at the Value Investing Congress. He had picked apart the bank's financial statements to show just how vulnerable it was, so I knew not to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Yet I now discovered that my own father had invested a significant sum in Lehman bonds without thinking to tell me. He explained that a financial advisor from one of the world's largest and most prominent banks had called him up to recommend these bonds, assuring him that they had a AAA rating from Moody's. He had felt particularly confident in buying them because he was aware that Moody's was one of my holdings, and he knew that I invested in companies with good products. But I understood exactly how this game worked. Professional investors were fleeing from Lehman in droves, so the Wall Street selling machine had kicked into high gear, touting this dross to overly trusting clients. With Lehman's usual investors shunning its bonds, the firm had to seek out a more gullible client base. My father's bank no doubt pocketed a fat commission as a reward for abusing him to serve its own ends. I let loose an angry tirade. How many times have I said that one should never buy anything that's being sold by Wall Street? Never! I like Moody's business, not their ratings. They always lag the market. As I spoke, I felt as if my throat was burning. My father wanted to know if he should get rid of the bonds, which were now being quoted at around 34 cents on the dollar. Yes, I said, sell them now. But it turned out that there was no liquidity at all, and his order was never executed. A few days later, on September the 15th, Lehman filed for Chapter 11. It was the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history. I felt angry and humiliated. A big part of my identity is wrapped up in an image of myself as the protector and builder of wealth for my family and friends. I'd failed, and I was hurt that my father had inadvertently disempowered me by neglecting to inform me before he bought the bonds. But this wasn't just a blow to my ego. It also rattled me because it made me wonder what else I didn't know, and what other chinks there were in my armor. I had assumed that my defenses were totally solid, but I was starting to sense that this wasn't the case. For one thing, my father was easily the largest investor in my fund. The fact that he had been duped into buying Lehman bonds could have a serious knock-on effect. With the market crashing, I had a long-awaited opportunity to be a dispassionate buyer of companies whose shares had plunged to ridiculously low prices. I knew that I had to pick my spots, but I had spent enough time studying economic history and investors like Buffett to know that this might well be the best time in my entire life to buy stocks. To do this, I needed my investors, especially my father, to stay calm during the storm. If his liquid assets were getting eroded, it would be that much harder for me to go against the crowd and continue buying while almost everyone else was in a panic. Knowing that my shareholders were facing these emotional and financial pressures placed an additional mental burden on me at a moment when I needed to be icily analytical. The pressure intensified in other ways that I could never have predicted. For example, at the time I employed a bright, hard-working equity analyst whom I regarded as a dependable ally. Then, one day in the fall of 2008, he came into my office, which I had come to think of as my bunker, and told me that he'd sold all of the stocks in his personal brokerage account. "I've gone to cash," he said. "I'm going to wait till things settle down and the outlook is clearer." I was stunned. "Are you out of your mind?" I asked, unable to conceal my disgust. Here was a guy who had proudly claimed to be a value investor and whom I was paying to be rational. He was supposed to be a like-minded soul, helping me to seize these incredible opportunities that the market was gifting us. Yet his emotions were so out of control that even he was getting swept up in the panic. He just couldn't take it anymore. This is a measure of how acute the stress can become at a time like this, even for an intelligent and level-headed analyst who had previously come up with some highly profitable investments for the fund. I would later decide never to hire another analyst, preferring not to expose my own mind to these insidious distortions. As usual, I should have done a better job of cloning Warren and Monish, neither of whom employed a full-time analyst. Needless to say, they were both buying cheap assets hand over fist at precisely the moment when weaker-minded investors were seeking the emotional comfort of cash. As the global financial crisis deepened, the turmoil was unbelievable. Yet the bursting of the housing bubble was hardly a surprise to me. A few years earlier, I had paid close attention when Buffett explained at a Berkshire annual meeting why he no longer owned Freddie Mac. He and Munger had spotted the early warning signals when lending standards and accounting disclosures began to deteriorate beyond their comfort level. I had also read some brilliant investment letters by the hedge fund manager Mike Burry, in which he cogently explained why there would be a disaster in housing and related financial markets. This is an important benefit of remaining in the right intellectual environment. Clear-headed investors like Einhorn, Buffett, Munger, and Burry had helped to keep my eyes wide open. As a result, I steered well away from the greatest danger areas. I shunned all housing-related businesses, including any company that financed them. Instead, my fund owned things like gas pipeline companies, which were about as far away from housing as I could get. Drilling for shale gas was a big growth market, and pipelines provided the cheapest mode of transportation from the gas fields to end users. I did own some financial stocks, but I was certain that they were safe and had access to the liquidity they needed. For example, MasterCard didn't participate directly in the capital markets, and it provided one of the two dominant payment systems in the world. The closest my portfolio got to the epicenter of the crisis was Moody's, which had rated instruments that helped to fuel it. But Moody's balance sheet wasn't at risk. It was merely issuing an opinion about the creditworthiness of different companies, rather than providing a guarantee, and there were plenty of precedents to show that they couldn't be held liable for expressing an opinion. I had worked hard to invest in companies that sold for significantly less than their intrinsic value. All of them had high-quality moats, and they were all prodigious cash generators. None were highly leveraged or needed regular access to capital markets. The credit crisis was dangerous for any company that was leveraged and needed continuous access to money, whereas the long-term health of my companies looked remarkably sound. So when I first heard the news that Lehman was imploding and that liquidity was drying up, it seemed like a non-issue. But it turned out that there was really no place to hide, especially for a long-only investor with a concentrated portfolio like mine, which consisted of around 15 stocks. I had successfully piloted the Aquamarine Fund through a number of previous market corrections, including the Asian crisis of 1997, the dot-com crash of 1999 to 2000, and the market jitters that followed September the 11th, 2001. In the fund's first 10 years, I had substantially beaten the indexes, quadrupling the money of my original investors. My worst year ever had been a 6.7% loss in 1999. But 2008 was something else. I'd never experienced an avalanche like this within my portfolio. The serious damage began in June when the fund fell by 11.8%. The following month, I was down another 3.5%, and then things started to get really ugly. In September, the fund fell by 6.8%. In October, it plunged by 20.3%, and in November, it tumbled by another 12.5%. For the year as a whole, I was down 46.7%. On paper, almost half my shareholders' money and my family's money had gone up in smoke. In the past, I had explicitly warned in my letters to shareholders that it was a statistical certainty that the fund would one day fall by as much as 50%. You only had to look at the tumultuous history of financial markets to know that this would eventually happen. The difficulty, of course, is predicting when these avalanches will occur. As a long-term investor, my choice, then and now, is not to attempt to time the market, which strikes me as an impossible task, at least for me. I also chose not to buy insurance, for example, by shorting an index or buying puts, since this reduces volatility but lowers your long-term rate of return. For my temperament, this approach works. Emotionally, 2008 was painful for me, but I could deal with these massive paper losses because I understood that they didn't reflect the intrinsic value of my investments. I knew that I'd be fine if I made it through to the other side without being forced to fold by external forces. At some level, I was also making a macroeconomic call that we weren't heading into a repeat of the Great Depression, since we had policymakers who understood the risks and were willing to use every available tool to avert disaster. It also helped that I had prepared myself for precisely this sort of turmoil. One of the key financial decisions I had made as an adult was that I would never live beyond my means or fall into debt. The most I've ever owed is a few thousand dollars on my credit cards, which I've always repaid promptly. I've never leased a car or taken out a mortgage to buy a house. In 2008, when the market imploded, I was renting an apartment and had enough cash set aside to ride out the storm. This attitude toward money is deeply embedded in my family's psyche. After fleeing from Nazi Germany in 1936, my grandfather used all of the savings he could take with him, a total of £1,000 in British currency, to build a house in Israel without borrowing a penny. When my parents moved our family to England in 1977, they bought a house in a less expensive area of London that they could afford, and when I bought a place in upstate New York, I did it with cash, not debt. My wealthy ancestors had lost their fortune when they were forced to escape from Germany. At some deep-seated level, I live in mortal fear of this happening again. Understanding that this is an integral part of my wiring, I knew that I needed to avoid debt since it would interfere with my ability to act rationally. Likewise, I don't invest borrowed money because this added stress would make it impossible for me to remain calm and clear-headed. My attitude toward debt had also been influenced by Warren Buffett, even before he told us the story of Rick Guerin's painful experience with leverage. At one point, Warren had a mortgage on his home in Omaha, but he's long since paid it off. In the past, he has also said that he never wants to get into serious debt because he doesn't want to discover how he's capable of behaving. I mentioned to him during our lunch that when I was growing up in Israel, my parents couldn't afford to take us on vacation or buy a TV. They would wait patiently until they could afford what they wanted instead of borrowing to buy it. Occasionally, for a treat, we would go for iced coffee at an elegant hotel, the Dan Acadia in Herzliya. It was an inexpensive and prudent way to live the good life. From a societal point of view, debt is a vital economic lubricant. Used in moderation, it's positively healthy. But for an individual investor, debt can be disastrous, making it even harder to stay in the game, both financially and emotionally, when the market turns against you. As Buffett wrote in his 2001 letter to shareholders, you only find out who is swimming naked when the tide goes out. One of my shareholders was a third-party marketer who had previously persuaded me to travel with her to Europe for dog and pony shows designed to attract new investors to my fund. She was so keen on the fund's long-term value approach that she'd invested $2 million in it herself, but her faith in long-term investing suddenly disintegrated and she cashed out in January 2009. I was flabbergasted. It wasn't clear if she couldn't bear the pain or if she was desperate for cash because she simply couldn't afford the losses we were suffering. What was clear was that her despair was an almost perfect signal that we had reached the point of maximum pessimism. A few months later, the markets bottomed and began to climb. All but one of my institutional investors also bailed out, partly because they had a need for liquidity themselves. Still, the vast majority of my shareholders stayed firm, trusting that things would turn around. Most importantly, my father, who had faced life-threatening dangers as an Israeli soldier, remained extraordinarily calm. At the height of the crisis, when nearly half of his life savings had been vaporized, he asked me if he should withdraw some money from the fund. I said it was the worst possible moment to sell stocks, and I told him that I'd rather live in a shack than take any cash off the table. To his eternal credit, he didn't withdraw a dime, even though he could have yanked out his money at short notice. His stake was large enough that he could effectively have shut down my business, but he never lost confidence in me. In retrospect, I realized that I was standing on the shoulders of a giant. Without his strength as a silent partner, I wouldn't have succeeded. For fund managers, this whole issue of shareholder redemptions can be fraught with stress and difficulty. Before the crisis, my fund had about $120 million in assets under management. The market crash had slashed this to barely $60 million. To make matters worse, shareholders redeemed around $10 million more. One reason was that my fund's 90-day notice period made it a relatively easy asset to liquidate. Some other hedge funds actually suspended redemptions, taking advantage of self-serving clauses buried deep inside their offering documents by shrewd lawyers. I found this unconscionable. To meet my investors' redemption requests, I had to be a net seller of stocks in an environment where they had never looked so cheap. By bailing out at this inopportune moment, a small minority of my investors made it far more difficult for me to act rationally and take advantage of these bargains. Instead, I had to allocate mental energy to the inordinately difficult task of deciding what to sell. This taught me an important lesson. At that moment, what I most envied about Buffett was not his prodigious intelligence, but his structural advantage. He had permanent capital to invest since Berkshire is a company, not a fund. This meant that he didn't have to worry at all about how to meet shareholder redemptions. As a result, he was free to make enormous investments in equities at the perfect moment. According to Warren, temperament is more important than IQ when it comes to investing. This is no doubt true, but I'm convinced that having a structural advantage is even more important. As for Monish, he had set up his fund so that investors could redeem shares only once a year. His investment losses in the market meltdown were even worse than mine, but he had to deal with redemption requests only once during the financial crisis, at the end of 2008. This structural advantage gave him more latitude than I had to think clearly about his portfolio. By contrast, the majority of my investors still owned a share class that allowed them to redeem quarterly. 10 years had passed since I founded the fund with this structure. Now, after all this time, I was paying the price for my mistake. It was a potent reminder of how important it is to create the right structure from the very beginning. In the midst of the crisis, I also envied Warren for his physical detachment from Wall Street and the investment herd. Unlike most professional investors, he seemed perfectly insulated from the fear and irrationality that had gripped the market. His small, low-key office in Omaha is located in Kiewit Plaza, which he shares with the Kiewit Corporation, a contractor that builds infrastructure such as roads, bridges, and tunnels. It's an ideal spot for a contrarian investor to think dispassionately about where the crowd might be going wrong. My own office in Manhattan's Carnegie Hall Tower was a terrible place to be in the midst of a financial crash. New York was at the heart of the crisis, and the building itself was filled with fearful investment professionals, including many hedge fund managers who were getting clobbered. Every morning I'd take a bus to work, no longer feeling that I should blow a few dollars on a cab. I would pass through the glass doors into the building's impressive lobby, which exudes an atmosphere of understated opulence. When I'd first moved into this skyscraper, I had felt like a Wall Street king, but now it felt more as if I were entering a hospital. The faces all around me were drawn and pensive. This might sound overstated, but these expressions reminded me most of the looks I had seen on people's faces as they walked uptown through Manhattan on 9/11. When I reached my office on the 25th floor, the mood was grim. In those brutal months, my employees were quieter and more serious than usual. There was no cheery banter. Nobody wanted to talk. While nothing was explicitly mentioned, they were clearly worried about their paychecks, and they were all dusting off their resumes. In the past, I'd mostly kept the door to my corner office ajar. Increasingly, I now closed it behind me, consciously trying to keep the outside world at bay so that this palpable gloom didn't infect my thinking. Looking back now on the financial crisis, I'm pleased at how well I kept my emotions in check. By then, I had a sufficiently strong emotional core that I didn't get swept away by all of these intense pressures. It also helped that I was a true believer in the enduring power of value investing. This approach had worked for me for a decade, and I had absolutely no doubt that it would continue to work for me over the long term, if only I could stay the course. Still, it wasn't easy to remain calm and positive. One way that I coped with the stress was to apply a strategy I had learned from Tony Robbins, studying heroes of mine who had successfully handled adversity, then imagining that they were by my side so that I could model their attitudes and behavior. One historical figure I used in this way was the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius. At night, I read excerpts from his Meditations. He wrote of the need to welcome adversity with gratitude as an opportunity to prove one's courage, fortitude, and resilience. I found this particularly helpful at a time when I couldn't allow myself to become fearful. I also tried to imagine how Sir Ernest Shackleton would have felt in my shoes. He had made grievous mistakes on his great expedition to Antarctica, for example, failing to land his ship Endurance when he could, and then abandoning his first camp too soon. Yet he succeeded in putting these errors behind him, and he ultimately saved the lives of everyone on his team. This helped me to realize that my own mistakes were an acceptable part of the process. Indeed, how could I possibly pilot the wealth of my friends and family without making mistakes or encountering the occasional storm? Like Shackleton, I needed to see that all was not lost and to retain my belief that I would make it through to the other side. With this support from the eminent dead, I managed to keep my wits about me. I quietly went over my portfolio again and again, double and triple checking to be sure that my holdings had the wherewithal to survive. Confident of my analysis, I refused to sell a single share of major investments such as American Express. By March 2009, its stock had plummeted to around $10. I held on and rode it to a ninefold gain in the years that followed. Only one of my holdings seemed too risky to keep. CarMax, a seller of second-hand vehicles. Its stock had already halved, but I was worried that the business model might be broken, given how difficult it had become for car buyers to obtain low-cost financing. Ultimately, I was proved wrong, and even CarMax bounced back. In this case alone, I had allowed the fears of the market to affect my rational thinking. It was a healthy reminder that I'm not immune to irrational fears, however carefully I try to guard against them. At the same time, I was also buying some incredibly cheap stocks, despite the burden of meeting shareholder redemptions. For example, I invested in London Mining PLC, which was selling at a discount to the value of its cash. I loaded up on Brookfield Office Properties, which owned prime real estate that was being valued at way below its replacement cost. I bought stock in Cresud, an Argentinian owner of large tracts of valuable farmland, which I was getting for free since the whole company was selling for less than the value of its stake in IRSA, a publicly traded real estate firm. I also invested in Fortescue Metals Group, which had developed exceptionally low-cost reserves of seaborne iron ore. The price of iron ore had collapsed, but I was certain that Chinese demand would continue to grow. These were elegant ideas. Not only were they remarkably cheap, but they each had catalysts that would inevitably emerge. Also, they didn't just have powerful earnings engines, but also substantial collateral value, so the odds of success were exceptionally high. All of these investment ideas emerged from conversations that I had with Monish, and I benefited immeasurably from his analytical brilliance. His thoughts and insights came at me thick and fast, and I was sometimes slow on the uptake. Monish joked that I seemed to be drinking from a fire hydrant. Our growing friendship was one of the most precious rewards of the Buffett lunch, since that rich experience drew Monish and me so much closer together. I was amazed by his generosity in sharing his unconventional wisdom with me, and it's hard to do justice to his importance in helping me to make the right investments throughout the credit crisis. All in all, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. Over the next few years, as the global economy recovered and normality slowly returned, every one of these stocks soared. For example, Brookfield doubled, Cresud tripled, and London Mining quadrupled. As I had thought at the time, the financial crisis may well have been a once-in-lifetime opportunity. On the investing front, I'd acquitted myself well. My core stock-picking process was good, but I could see that there were still fundamental things that I needed to change about how I ran the fund, and for that matter, how I ran my life. The financial crisis had shown me that investment success isn't just a matter of identifying great stock ideas. As I had learned through painful experience, I also had to create the best possible environment for myself, physically, intellectually, and emotionally, so that I could operate more effectively and make myself less vulnerable to the sort of negative influences I'd encountered during the financial crisis. Like Warren and Monish, I needed to be more strategic in the way I constructed this environment. I couldn't clone their intelligence, but I could see with increasing clarity that I needed to clone the aspects of their environment that had given them such a structural advantage, so I decided to hit the reset button. Among the biggest changes I would make, leaving New York for Zurich in the summer of 2009. Chapter 8. My Own Version of Omaha. Creating the Ideal Environment. One of the biggest challenges for any investor is that there are so many forces that mess with our minds. We like to think of ourselves as rational creatures, which to some extent we are, but the truth is a little murkier. The financial crisis had demonstrated with brutal efficiency just how irrational investors can be, especially in extreme situations. The so-called professionals, myself included, are by no means immune to these mind-warping distortions. I had witnessed this firsthand as my equity analyst, my institutional investors, and my third-party marketer all cracked amid the pressure of a market crash, cashing out at precisely the moment when they should have been buying. It's reassuring to talk smugly about the madness of crowds, but what about the madness of the intellectual and financial elite? In my experience, we are capable of the same insanity. Indeed, it's often people of my ilk who are driving the craziness. The mind itself is a confounded thing, woefully ill-suited to the task of investing. This is not a science book or a weighty tome about the structure of the brain, but it's worth taking a few moments to ponder why it's so hard to think and invest in a rational manner. People often misguidedly regard the brain as one structure, a neocortex that rationally takes in information, computes it, and spits out the answer. Danny Kahneman, a trailblazing psychologist who won a Nobel Prize for Economics in 2002, describes this aspect of the brain's processes with the phrase, thinking slow. For my part, I used to have a deluded image of myself as the equivalent of a fighter pilot, intensely focusing on the instrument panel in the cockpit of my jet, making optimal decisions and operating in full control of all the aircraft's levers. Much of what we do at fine universities is intended to develop this rational, higher-thinking aspect of our minds. My friend Ken Schubenstein teaches an advanced investment class at Columbia Business School. It's a phenomenal course that provides an enormous amount of useful insight into the investment research process. But all this learning and analysis is based upon the assumption that, when students graduate, it will be their rational neocortex that makes the investment decisions. The problem is that there is also a subrational, instinctive part of the brain, which Kahneman describes with the phrase thinking fast, where much of our decision-making actually takes place. Of course, I'm grossly oversimplifying an endlessly rich subject. If you'd like to research this further, you can read more lucid explanations by people like Kahneman, Dan Ariely, Jason Zweig, Joseph Ledoux, and Anthony Damasio. Reading works by these and other experts on behavioral finance and neuroeconomics, I became fascinated by the quirks and complexities of our decision-making processes. For example, the neurologist Benjamin Libet showed how a decision to take an action originates in the brain before the subject is aware that a decision has been made. Then there was the famous 19th century case of Phineas Gage, who had suffered an accident that interfered with only one part of his brain. He appeared to function normally, but he was unable to make rational decisions. I was also intrigued by research showing how the brain deals with signals that arrive at different times. The sight of a person's lip movements arrives instantaneously, while the sound they make arrives later, yet we perceive that these signals occur simultaneously. In other words, our brain constructs our reality, and it may not be doing so in an accurate manner. Research of this kind helped me to see that the brain is a much less wieldy tool than we'd like to imagine. For participants in the stock market, one of the biggest problems is that the subrational, instinctive part of the brain is subject to dire mood swings, including outbreaks of irrational optimism and irrational pessimism. Indeed, money-related issues often activate the subrational parts of our brains. In situations of heightened financial risk, when we feel that we are in jeopardy, our subconscious instincts are activated. The neocortex can subsequently rationalize our decisions. To understand who we really are as humans and investors, it also helps to consider the environment in which we evolved. Roughly speaking, anatomically modern humans with large brains have been around for about 200,000 years. The part of our brain that evolved most recently is the rational neocortex, but for much of our history, we operated in a dramatically different environment. Today, there are substantial parts of our mental apparatus that evolved to help us survive in the wilderness that was home to our hunter-gatherer ancestors. These primitive survival routines embedded in our brains are easily capable of bypassing the neocortex. We might like to perceive ourselves as potential Isaac Newtons, but it's perilous to forget that we also have this other aspect of our nature. Indeed, Newton himself would have been better off if he'd recognized this, given that he was an infamously dumb investor who lost his life savings in the South Sea bubble. As Newton wryly observed, "I can calculate the movement of stars, but not the madness of men." The problem is not just that our brains are highly irrational. It's also that the economic universe operates in ways that are mind-blowingly complicated. The elegant economic theories that I learned at Oxford and Harvard blinded me to this awesome complexity. A few years after I started investing, the money manager Nick Sleep introduced me to the Santa Fe Institute, a transdisciplinary research community. I knew that Bill Miller, a remarkably smart fund manager at Legg Mason, was on the Institute's board, so I started reading some of its research papers. The key idea that I learned is to think of the economy as a complex adaptive system. Economists hate this notion because we can't model a complex adaptive system or use the type of math that we've been trained to deploy. We also tend to be drawn to attractive, harmonious, hard-to-learn ideas, such as the general equilibrium theory. This theory provides a wonderful account of how the world ought to work, and it can be a useful guide for policymakers, but it distorts our perception of reality. Polymath investors like Bill Miller and Charlie Munger were quick to recognize that these standard economic models of the world are inadequate when it comes to the markets, and to see that models derived from biology may work better. Inspired by the Santa Fe Institute, I read Journey to the Ants by Bert Holdobler and Edward O. Wilson. Much of the book is devoted to describing the different survival strategies used by ant species and to exploring how these different species have co-evolved and competed with each other. This one book taught me more about economics than I'd learned in all my years at university. That may sound nuts, but it's true. Why? Because an ant colony, like the economy, is a complex adaptive system. Reading about ants was a revelation. For example, it turns out that ant colonies operate by a simple set of basic rules that enable them to resolve a myriad of difficult survival problems. I realized instantly that I was discovering models that would be useful for me in analyzing the financial and economic world. My thoughts went to Munger and his lattice work of mental models, so I sent him a copy of Journey to the Ants. To my delight, he replied with a short handwritten note saying that he had long intended to read the book. Meanwhile, I resolved to spend more time reading books about biology. These studies deepened my sense that it's helpful to think of the economy as an evolving and infinitely complex biological ecosystem. Companies, like ant species, must adopt strategies that enable them to thrive, or they will be at risk of extinction. As I soon discovered, other areas of complexity research also provide helpful models for how the economic world operates. For example, the Danish theoretical physicist Per Bach co-authored a classic study of sand piles that showed what happens when you keep dropping grains of sand in one area. The resulting pile reaches a state of self-organized criticality. Avalanches then occur, but it's impossible to predict either their timing or their size. This model offers intriguing insights into market crashes, which have much in common with these avalanches. For investors, the bottom line is to avoid states of self-organized criticality, which is essentially what occurred in the stock market before the crash of 2008 to 2009. The point is that the neat economic theories I had learned at university didn't come close to describing the true complexities of the economy or the financial markets. At the same time, I had also come to see that our brains are hopelessly limited in the face of this overwhelming complexity. This imbalance is a serious problem for investors. Here we are with our little irrational brains and our overly simplistic economic theories, somehow hoping to make sense of this unbelievably complex world. What chance do we have? This isn't just a case of self-indulgent intellectual theorizing. It's a very real challenge for every investor. Is there any way, then, of tilting the balance in our favor so that we increase the odds of victory in a game that's so heavily stacked against us? This is the question that underlies the next few chapters of this book. In retrospect, I should have been far more skeptical about the economic models I had learned at university. So you'll be glad to hear that I'm not going to bore you with erudite discussions of the Black-Scholes model of option pricing, Keynesian macroeconomics and sticky prices, the ISLM macroeconomic model, rational expectations, the Herfindahl industrial concentration ratio, or the Rüdiger-Dornbusch exchange rate overshooting model. This is, of course, sexy stuff that might serve you well if you're looking for love at a Mensa cocktail party or a gathering of central bankers. It might also get you a first-class degree and a great teaching gig. But in my experience, it's not particularly helpful when it comes to investing. The trouble is, economic theories like these tend to be based on intellectually elegant assumptions about how the world operates, not on the messy reality in which we actually live. That said, there are plenty of useful things I learned at university that shouldn't be junked. For example, it's indispensable for any serious investor to know how to read a company's accounts. This doesn't mean simply grasping the difference between cash and accrual accounting. It also involves understanding the various ways that accounting rules can be used to skew the headline earnings numbers, not to mention the ability to tell whether the quality of earnings is increasing or decreasing. If you've picked up an MBA or a CFA, you've already gleaned the basic mechanics of this type of analysis. If not, there are lots of books that can impart this fundamental knowledge, including seminal works by Ben Graham and David Dodd, Marty Whitman, John Michaljevic, Seth Klarman, and Joel Greenblatt. You don't need me to go over that well-trodden ground again. Unfortunately, most investment books tend to focus on technical skills. It's fine to study basic concepts like return on investment, PE ratios and the like, but these things aren't hard, and they will get you only so far. Anyone who's smart enough to make it through business school can figure out how to dissect 10Ks, 10Qs, and other financial documents. The real challenge, in my view, is that the brain itself, which got us to where we are, is the weakest link. It's like a little boat, adrift in a sea of irrationality and subject to unexpected storms, and it's incompletely understood even by the most brilliant neuroscientists, let alone by investors. When I started to read up on behavioral finance and neuroeconomics, there was a thrilling sense that I was fathoming some of the deepest mysteries of how the brain functions and malfunctions. But initially, I mistakenly assumed that I could rely on my intellectual powers to overcome these irrational tendencies. As I read about the brain's shortcomings, I would nod knowingly, reassuring myself that I wouldn't trip up now that I had a better understanding of where these mental tripwires lay. But I gradually learned that intellectual knowledge and self-awareness are simply not enough. The difficulty is that we can't use the brain to override the brain, so we remain vulnerable to these mental shortcomings even when we know about them. What then is the solution? This, I hope, is where I can help you by sharing what I've learned so far. Through painful experience, both at D.H. Blair and in the financial crisis, I discovered that it's critical to banish the false assumption that I am truly capable of rational thought. Instead, I found that one of my only advantages as an investor is the humble realization of just how flawed my brain really is. Once I accepted this, I could design an array of practical workarounds based on my awareness of the minefield within my mind. As it happens, this minefield may be particularly treacherous in my case. Around 2004, a friend who is on the faculty of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine sent me for an examination with his colleague, Dr. Mary Solanto. She conducted a battery of tests and concluded that I have attention deficit disorder, ADD. The tests showed that I was capable of periods of extraordinary hyperfocus, especially at times of high stress, but that I was equally capable of falling through attention trapdoors when it came to the more mundane things in life. I could think great thoughts, but my attention could shift so easily that I had little grasp of basic things like what time it was or where I'd left my keys. To deal with my ADD, I needed to develop an array of simple workarounds. For example, installing big clocks in my office to help me keep track of time, having a clear desk so that I wouldn't get distracted, and putting objects in the same places so that I wouldn't lose them quite so often. In hiring a personal assistant, I specified that a key part of the job was to watch over me so that I wouldn't mess up simple tasks like catching flights, remembering appointments, or closing the front door when I left our office building. All of this focus on building workarounds and circuit breakers into my everyday life proved to be incredibly helpful, not just in dealing with my ADD, but also in becoming a better investor. The truth is, all of us have mental shortcomings, though yours may be dramatically different from mine. With this in mind, I began to realize just how critical it is for investors to structure their environment to counter their mental weaknesses, idiosyncrasies, and irrational tendencies. Following my move to Zurich, I focused tremendous energy on this task of creating the ideal environment in which to invest, one in which I'd be able to act slightly more rationally. The goal isn't to be smarter, it's to construct an environment in which my brain isn't subjected to quite such an extreme barrage of distractions and disturbing forces that can exacerbate my irrationality. For me, this has been a life-changing idea. I hope that I can do it justice here, because it's radically improved my approach to investing while also bringing me a happier and calmer life. As we shall see in a later chapter, it wasn't just my environment that would change. I would also overhaul my basic habits and investment procedures to work around my irrationality. My brain would still be hopelessly imperfect, but these changes would subtly tilt the playing field to my advantage. To my mind, this is infinitely more helpful than focusing on things like analysts' quarterly earnings reports, Tobin's Q ratio, or pundits' useless market predictions, the sort of noise that preoccupies most investors. The financial crisis had shown me beyond doubt that managing the non-rational part of my brain had to become an integral part of managing my stock portfolio. It also highlighted how hard it was for me to do this in Manhattan. We're all wired a little differently, but New York, with its restless energy, competitive spirit, and pockets of extreme wealth, accentuated some aspects of my own irrational nature that aren't conducive to good investing. I needed to be in a place where I could think calmly and invest for the long term without the pressure of other people's expectations or the distraction of all the frenzied activity buffeting me in New York. This is not to say that it isn't a fine base for some great investors. David Einhorn has thrived there. So have the managers of the Sequoia Fund. But I suspect that it's harder for people like me who flocked to New York from elsewhere and therefore lack the local roots that give emotional stability to people raised there. For outsiders, it's too easy to get unbalanced by the unbridled appetites, including greed and envy, that financial centers like New York and London can inflame. To borrow a memorable term from Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, these big cities are extremistan. As we know from various studies, the disparity between our own wealth and our neighbor's wealth can play a significant role in determining our happiness. If so, then reading about a New York-based multi-billionaire like the Blackstone Group's Stephen Schwarzman may well trigger a destabilizing reaction in my irrational brain. Unless we have robust ways of dealing with these mind-bending forces, we can't avoid being knocked off course by them. For example, the proximity of so much extreme wealth might make it more tempting for me to swing for the fences with my investments instead of focusing calmly on making a decent compounded return without undue risk. For me at least, it seemed wiser to live in a place where the differences are less extreme. Given my particular set of flaws and vulnerabilities, I figured that I would stand a better chance of operating somewhat rationally in the kind of place that Taleb describes as mediocristan, where life is more mundane. So I started actively to consider alternatives to Manhattan. For a while, I thought seriously of moving to Omaha, given how well it had worked for Warren. I also considered Irvine, California, where Monish lives. I contemplated other American cities like Boston, Grand Rapids, and Boulder, and I thought about relatively low-key European cities such as Munich, Lyon, Nice, Geneva, and Oxford. But in the end, Laurie and I agreed on Zurich. I had gone there often as a child and had always liked it. More recently, I'd also read studies in which Zurich was routinely ranked as the world's leading city for quality of life. It wasn't hard to see why. It's a small, safe, manageable place with handsome architecture, clean air and water, and superb physical infrastructure. It has good public schools. There are beautiful mountains and great skiing just minutes away. It also has an excellent airport, easily accessible from the downtown area with direct flights to places like New York, San Francisco, Singapore, Shanghai, and Sydney. While Zurich is an expensive place to live, it's also highly egalitarian because everybody has access to more or less the same things, from pristine lakes to public swimming pools that are even better than the private one I'd enjoyed at our fancy country club in upstate New York. Likewise, Zurich's unsurpassed public transport system is so efficient that even local billionaires use it. The fact that the rich don't exist in an alternate reality that seems way out of reach for everyone else reduces the envy and the sense of lack that it's easy to feel in cities like New York and London. I don't want to suggest that Zurich is perfect, but it has one other trait that seems remarkable to me. It's genuinely built on trust. For example, on the train system, tickets are seldom checked and there are no turnstiles. In stores, customers routinely buy wine and other products on credit and have them delivered to their homes, along with the invoice. Residents are part of a web of deserved trust, and this tends to bring out the best in them. In a way, this is a Buffett-esque view of life. Warren treats the managers of his companies with considerable trust, granting them the latitude to make their own decisions, and they respond by doing everything they can to live up to his expectations. Zurich also struck me as a place where I could live in mental peace, a quiet, pleasant, slightly bland setting where there isn't too much going on. Here I could focus on my family and my fund without undue disturbance. Occasionally, people ask me, but isn't it boring there? My answer, boring is good. As an investor, that's exactly what I want, because distraction is a real problem. What I really need is a plain, unobtrusive background that's not overly exciting, and I'm certainly not alone in finding Zurich conducive to clear thought. Historically, the city has provided a space for free contemplation to residents as diverse as Carl Jung, James Joyce, Richard Wagner, Vladimir Lenin, and Albert Einstein, not to mention Tina Turner. It was also important that in Zurich I wouldn't be surrounded by people in the investment business. This would make it easier to go against the crowd without the risk that their thinking would seep into my own mind. Zurich is also far enough off the beaten track that not too many people would visit me. The friends and relatives who cared the most would come, but I wouldn't have to devote too much time to relationships that were less central to my life. This might sound cold and unsentimental, but these are the sort of things that I needed to consider as I constructed an environment that suited my idiosyncratic character and priorities. After all, in moving to Zurich, I had a chance to start over with a clean slate, putting into practice all that I had learned about how I could function more effectively. I didn't want to blow it. Next, I set about finding the perfect office, another key component of my new environment. Initially, I made a mistake, renting an office for a year on the Bahnhofstrasse, a ritzy street that is Zurich's own enclave of extremistan. It's an elegant area, full of expensive stores, but super-rich settings like this are not ideal for me since they stimulate unhealthy appetites, so I soon decided to move to an office on the other side of the river, a 15-minute walk from the Bahnhofstrasse's glitz and glamour. For me, this feels like a safe distance. The psychologist Roy Baumeister has shown that willpower is a limited resource, so we have to be careful not to deplete it. In fact, his lab discovered that even the simple act of resisting chocolate chip cookies left people with less willpower to perform subsequent tasks. In my case, I don't want to waste my limited energy guarding myself against the envy and greed that a place like the Bahnhofstrasse might trigger in me. It's better simply to construct my environment so that I'm not exposed to these destabilizing forces, which are likely to intensify my irrationality. The key is to free my mind from any unnecessary mental effort so I can use it for more constructive tasks that are likely to benefit me and my shareholders. As I pondered these issues, I also began to recognize that other investors I admire had adopted a similar approach to building their environment, whether consciously or not. Monish, for one, works in a less-than-glamorous office park in Southern California with no other financial institutions nearby. I once asked him why he hadn't set himself up in an attractive office in one of Irvine's fancy shopping centers, close to his favorite restaurants. "Oh, Guy," he replied, "I don't need all that razzmatazz." I have no doubt that he understands what the area around him can do to his mind. Likewise, Seth Klarman, one of the most successful investors on the planet, works out of a decidedly unflashy office in Boston, far from the intoxications of Wall Street. If he wanted, he could easily rent the top floor of a gleaming skyscraper overlooking the Charles River. Nick Sleep set up his office in London near a Cornish pasty shop on the King's Road, far from the grandeur of Mayfair, which has become Britain's hedge fund mecca. Alan Bonello, the manager of White River Investment Partners, works out of a nondescript office in San Francisco, nowhere near the city's financial district. And Buffett, as we've discussed, is tucked away in Omaha's Kiewit Plaza, another building that is not exactly known for its razzmatazz. This strikes me as a significant yet largely unrecognized factor in the success of these investors. Small wonder, then, that I wanted to create my own version of Omaha. That said, I'm different from Buffett, and not just in terms of IQ points. For one thing, it's important for me to have a pleasant view from my office, whereas he's not fussed about such aesthetic considerations. While I like to look out on trees or something similarly cheering, he routinely keeps the blinds drawn in his office. But in other substantive ways, I consciously modeled the environment he'd created in Omaha. For example, Warren lives about a 10-minute drive from his office, which is slightly outside the city center. Monish's office in Irvine is also about 10 minutes from his home, and it's slightly outside the city center. I mirrored them, selecting an office that's a 12-minute walk or 7-minute tram ride from my home and that's slightly outside the city centre. For me, it works to be outside the heart of the city, partly because this makes it less likely that too many people will drop by the office opportunistically. They need a stronger reason to make this effort, so their visits tend to be more worthwhile. These decisions were carefully considered. For example, Monish and I had specifically discussed commuting times, reaching the conclusion that the ideal commute takes around 10 to 20 minutes. This is close enough to improve one's quality of life, but far enough to establish a separation between work and home. For people like me, who get obsessive about their jobs, it's useful to have this separation. We need to see our families and spend time at home when we're not just buried in work. For the same reason, it's important to have hobbies. Among other things, I run and ski, which not only makes me healthier and happier, but clears my mind and strengthens my detachment from the mood swings of the market. If I spend that time holed up in my office, single-mindedly analyzing stocks, I'm certain that my decision-making and my investment returns would suffer, along with my health and family life. In any case, everything is interconnected. My original motivation for creating a better environment had been to boost my returns, but these decisions also led to a better life. Within the office itself, I was equally careful to construct an environment that